This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The other thing that I've learned over working in the inside the system for the last 8 years is no amount of checks and balances, no rule book, no code of practice can regulate away the need for an individual's sense of morality. If you don't have a sense of morality and a moral compass, you will corrupt anything in politics. And I think as a society, we've moved away from this need to have a sense of moral judgment. And I think that's a real shame.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, there was a backlash over a council's plans to fine people over foul language, and residents told of their 16-year sewage hell. I'm Senior News Editor Nikki White, standing in for regular host Simon Finlay, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who covers borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
Our special guest today is Medway councillor and Tory party insider Robbie Lammas. So, Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
So, alongside our fellow political reporter, Ollie Leader, I've actually been covering the latest in a very long-running saga in Thanet, where the council's been trying to impose regulation and possibly even fines on residents for using foul language in public and that sort of thing.
How exactly have they been trying to do that?
So, of course, it's through a public spaces protection order. They're these legal instruments. Most councils have them. They're essentially a way of the council criminalising things which wouldn't otherwise be illegal in specific areas, like, for example, you know, abusive language and attempt to crack down on antisocial behaviour. In this case, their plan PS SBO bans many things, but one of which is what they say is foul or abusive language which degrades or humiliates others. They already tried to implement an order to a similar effect last year, but after a legal threat from the Free Speech Union, the council dropped the plans. But this time around, they say they're sure the rules are legally airtight, there's adequate protections for free speech and so on, and they're planning to push ahead with it.
So now they're set to actually fight a legal battle?
It seems so. Lord Toby Young of Acton, the Conservative Lord and founder of the Free Speech Union, was in Margate the other day telling us that his organisation is going to take the council to court over it and that they're pretty certain of winning. They say it represents a clear infringement on the right to free speech and could be arbitrarily enforced by council officers and police, and even rolled around some ad boards around the town, personally mocking the council leader, Rick Everett, to make the point. Councillor Everett didn't want to speak for the article, but he did put a video on Facebook responding to Toby Young, so clearly it's taking up at least some space in his mind.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. Robert, what's been going on in Medway?
This week I spoke with some residents in Kingsware Gardens in Strood, where they say their management company, Orbit, isn't making necessary repairs which have been causing sewage problems for the last 16 years, and they believe the system for reporting problems is deliberately frustrating.
The problems have been going on for 16 years?
Yes. Basically, there are persistent problems where the ground floor toilets clog and attempts to unblock them result in broken pipes, sewage spills and sewage backing up through sinks in both the bathrooms and the kitchens. This is a problem which a number of residents said they had been facing, but when reported, Orbit say it's not an emergency repair job. When it is fixed, residents say it's only a matter of time before it breaks again. Recently, a more in-depth investigation was made, and it was found a pipe which connects all the affected properties had collapsed and was likely the source of the issues, which have been going on since 2009.
So what do the residents want?
Well, they obviously want this fixed, but there are other associated issues with general repairs, mould and other damage, which they say are slow to be resolved, because when they report an issue, the reports get lost in the Orbit system, and so residents call up to see when things will be fixed and find they have to start all over again, going over all the details from scratch. They just want Orbit to fulfil their end of the management bargain, which residents are paying over £2,700 a year in service charges for. A spokesperson for Orbit said they had visited the properties and identified problems and were working on fixing them and would keep residents up to date on progress.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to Kent Politics Podcast at thekmgroup.co.uk.
Our guest this week has represented Princess Park Ward in Medway since August 2021, but as well as being at the grassroots level of the Conservative Party, he's also served as a parliamentary researcher and special advisor for a number of MPs, and eventually became the chief of staff for Richard Holden, chairman of the party, so has seen the British politics from both ends of the scale. Councillor Robbie Lammas, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. So to sort of introduce yourself to our listeners, tell us a bit about your background.
Well, my mum moved us out of London when I was about 1 year old and pretty much raised full-time in Medway. I went away for university to Royal Holloway in Egham in Surrey, but pretty much primary school, secondary school, and now back now as an adult, everything Medway-based, although spend a lot of time, obviously, in central London, but that's very normal for lots of people in Kent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously you're here because you're a councillor and you're very involved in politics. When did that sort of start for you?
It was actually started when I was 13 years of age, when we went on holiday to Egypt, and I was surprised to learn that Tutankhamun was 13 when he became pharaoh. I remember saying to my mum, I don't understand, why is he king but I'm not king? And she said, well, you can't be king, but there is something called politics, you should take a look at it. So I actually got involved in youth politics at Medway Council.
Right.
And got bit by the bug. Didn't pursue it at university, funny enough, though. I was more interested in other things.
Right.
And then came back to it later on. I was doing a couple of jobs after university, trying to find my feet. And then my local MP, Tracy Crouch, tapped me up and said, do you want to go leafleting? And I naively thought that, you know, the Conservative Party was all about dinner jackets and fancy dinners. And I remember meeting her in Alsford Tesco's behind the bins when it was pouring with rain, and it was pretty much me and her, and we went leafleting for an hour. She said, you're really good at this, come back tomorrow. So I did. Then I came back the next day and the next day, and in the end she gave me an internship in Parliament, which I was not expecting. And then rest is history, as they say.
Yeah. And so what was it that sort of drew you to it? She said you were very good at leafleting. What do you think you bring to it?
My draw to politics is that I have a very low tolerance for injustice, and everything is controlled by politics, and I don't like to be controlled. So essentially, I like to try and influence things to shape things for the better. And my central thrust of my personal philosophy, if you want to call it that, is all about aspiration and cracking on and doing well. And I think that's what separates Conservatives from the Labour Party and socialists, the idea being that Conservatives believe that you can get on and achieve better and you should be supported in doing so, whereas you tend to find on the left people just resent those who are better off than them and believe that they can achieve things by taking from them rather than creating wealth themselves.
Yeah. So obviously Tracy Crouch, you studied to work for her and you're a parliamentary researcher, is that right?
Yeah, so first of all, yeah.
What does that involve?
Oh, wow. I mean, MPs' offices, for those who haven't worked in them, are like individually run family laundrettes. There's this idea that you go to this big institution. You do in the civil service, but working for an MP is not a civil service job. You're employed legally and practically to the member. So essentially, you're like a private assistant. And it comes from the days of having private assistants. Of course, back then in Churchill's day and earlier on, you had to be wealthy in order to pay for them. Right. And some still can do that. Like, for example, the trade unions pay for a lot of researchers for the Labour group. But the state now funds that function. So in terms of what you do a lot of reading, a lot of following the order paper in the chamber, following the news, such as KM, particularly if you're a Kent MP, you know, following the KM is essential. The BBC, national news, responding to constituent queries, seeking redress of grievance, and then campaigning.
You obviously stuck around and you developed and kept going. What was it that you really enjoyed about it?
Oh, I was obsessed. I loved everything about it. I loved the order paper. I loved the traditions. One of the things I read at university was a topic on comparative politics, which was comparing our system, the Westminster system, to those of European countries such as Germany and also the US system in Washington, D.C. And I just loved the fact that we have this ancient English Parliament, now British Parliament, which has been the centre point for people seeking redress of grievance and the preservation of civil liberties for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, going all the way back to Magna Carta in 1215. I mean, it is really unique.
Yeah.
That's why it's often called the mother of parliaments. But that's a mistake. The original quote from the Victorian era is the mother to parliaments, because it birthed so many of the institutions that govern the world today.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, the Palace of Westminster, that's quite a spectacular place to go into work every day.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because when I go to work other places now, I often have a problem with the lack of palatial architecture. I've got so spoiled and so used to it. I was like, where's the gold, you know? Mm. Like, where's the shiny stuff? But it is remarkable. And that was fortuitous that it happened to be redecorated after a fire in 1834. Mm. Which was called by the burning of tally sticks, which looks like Harry Potter wands. And famously, MPs lost them before they would collect their salary, before they returned back to their home shires at the end of session, because they would have the tally sticks clipped with their bar tabs. So if they lost it, they could claim they drank less than they actually did. So MPs have been at it forever.
You then went on to be a special advisor. What does that entail?
The special advisor gig is kind of a weird one. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is quite a sort of progression structure from researcher to senior researcher, chief of staff. But then the special advisor is very much at the sole discretion of a member you happen to be already working for or one that you know very well. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's only whilst they are in the cabinet. And not all cabinet positions get one as well. It essentially involves becoming the filter as well as the eyes and ears of that person inside the government system, or in my case, how the government system interacted with the Conservative Party system. Mm-hmm. And you have to filter through an enormous volume of information and actually often advise officials on your members' behalf as if they were giving the advice themselves. Mm. But a huge function of the role also is what they call horizon scanning, which is basically trying to stop them getting into trouble and also trying to achieve some things as well for the country, which many people actually forget.
Mm. I mean, is that quite a difficult role? Is it a lot of hard work, a lot of hard yards?
I never found the reading or the politics side of it hard. What I found very hard is coping with the lack of sleep.
Right.
I've realised now, as I'm in my 30s now, that I need 8 hours a night, whereas there was a long time I was running on 5 hours a night. And not only that, is when you're trying to build your network and gain these levers that you can then pull at a later stage. In London, that's all done at pubs. Mm. So not only are you working all day long, but then you're spending every single evening eating and drinking with all of these people, so you're never off,
right?
You're always on. And that's why they become a bubble and so detached from reality, is essentially they spend all of their effort talking to people with motivated allegiances, if that makes sense, with things they want to achieve. They forget that journalists have a job. They forget that lobbyists have a job. And they end up talking to the bubble, and that's the mistake that they get into, I think.
You became chief of staff for Richard Holden for a number of years, and he eventually became the chairman of the Conservative Party, including during the general election last year. Yeah. And you were there in the thick of it. Yeah. What was that like, that general election campaign?
Very frustrating for me because you led to believe that you have this influence and that your member does, but actually the way it transpired in reality was that very much not a lot of power. I was very frustrated with the direction of the Conservative Party machine in the run-up to the last general election. And I actually had blazing rows with the guy in charge of the campaign and told him precisely what was going to happen and why, and that they should look more to what Trump was doing in America in terms of the way he was campaigning, the tactics, the messaging he was doing, how he was talking to people's grievances and their worries and fears, for example. And I was dismissed quite a lot, and I found it a very grueling process, but I was vindicated by the result in terms of being correct in what I predicted. But that was not a unique prediction on my behalf, and also I would much rather have won.
Was it a case of... I mean, there's lots been discussion about why Rishi Sunak called it when he did, and if he'd have delayed, maybe it would have turned out different. Do you think that there was a possible outcome where the Conservatives could have won the election? It's just because of whether it be the method of campaigning or just circumstances didn't play out the right way. Was there a path where they could have won?
I'm not sure there was a pathway up to the end of the Parliament. The latest date they could have pulled the trigger would have been January this year, the absolute constitutionally latest date. I'm not sure that there was a circumstance left where the Conservatives could have won a majority, but we certainly could have performed a lot better than we did, which of course infamously was the worst election result in history.
Mm, yeah. You mentioned Trump and the mm-hmm. American election. You went over and campaigned.
At my own expense.
At your own expense. Yeah. Why did you decide to do that?
Because I see Trump as a major disruptive figure. And I understand what he's trying to achieve for his economic policies for working class Americans. Mm-hmm. And I also understand fully the impact US policy, especially economic policy, has on the rest of the world, including Britain. And I wanted some of the things he was trying to achieve for America, for the world and for the UK. So I saw it as really important to go. Mm. Plus also, I was fascinated by the similarities and differences. Mm. One of the things that really attracted me to this particular campaign was that they were doing this thing called door-to-door canvassing, right. Which obviously we do all the time in England, right? But you imagine the geographies over there so different with the huge driveways, you know, mm-hmm. If you're in southern states, for example, it's just too hot or you'd have to drive to the next neighbour. It doesn't work. But in certain key swing areas, such as the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, the geography is such, it's basically like a posh English estate,
right.
The equivalent of what would be posh for us. But to them, it's just standard, but just in terms of the distances. Mm. So they were trialling this thing. And I went over there, I was like, well, I really know how to do this. I've do this forever. So I got to show them how we do it, and it was really quite interesting.
Mm. What are sort of the, apart from that distance, I mean, money is a huge thing over there. They spend way more than mm-hmm. we do on campaigns. But what are the other sort of differences about the ways that political parties over there campaign? And is there anything that we can learn?
Yeah, and actually all of the political parties in the UK have learned already. One of the things that happened in America first was this switch from typical voting allegiances and party basis and identity towards issues. So up until about the late 1990s, in the UK, 80% of people never changed the way they vote. So you're playing for a very small percentage of swing voters, right? Mm-hmm. So change was more incremental. Whereas today, the latest estimates suggest that as much as 65% of the voting population have no allegiance to any party whatsoever.
Right.
What they do gravitate towards is issues.
Right.
And that's what Trump knew so well. He knew that if he spoke to the main issue of concern, which for them was the southern border, he could attract voters from all party colours, and he did.
Mm. I mean, obviously, America generally is more further to the right than we are politics mm-hmm. here in the UK. Obviously, it was, as you say, it was your decision to go over there, and you paid mm-hmm. for it all yourself. Was there any sort of trepidation among some of your colleagues about going over there, or were they just kind of like, well, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do?
My boss didn't want me to go because he didn't want me to leave.
Right.
And like do my own thing for a little bit, because he was worried about me leaving him. Mm. That was a whole episode. I don't think he ever really did give me permission in the end. But anyway, sometimes it's better in life to ask for forgiveness than permission when you really want to do something. Mm. But yeah, it was a bit choppy. But no, there's much more support for Trump in the Conservative Party and also amongst the population, especially in Kent, than lots of people would actually dare to admit.
Bringing it back to our own mm-hmm. politics now, since the election last year, Reform have obviously been grabbing a lot of headlines. They're mm-hmm. sort of the main story. Just recently here in Kent, ex-Tory Adam Holloway defected to Reform. Do you understand why former Tory MPs or existing Tory MPs decide that Reform is the way forward? Do you understand their sort of logic of why they do that?
Yeah, especially Holloway's, because essentially what he's saying is that I remain a Conservative. You know, I'm not changing, but my population that I seek to serve again is telling me that they do not sufficiently trust the Conservative Party to give you that opportunity. So the only way you're going to gain that opportunity is to rebrand yourself as Reform and try and go through with that vehicle. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a pragmatic thing. Some people see it as weak, but sometimes I see it as kind of, you know, if you think that you're above what your people are telling you, then that's when you come up into problems. If the people are telling you something, mm-hmm. you know, there is some wisdom in listening to that. Mm. As to whether or not his decision will turn out to be electorally successful, is yet to be seen. However, what I will say, having campaigned fairly recently, like in the last couple of months, in his constituency for local candidate Jordan Mead, who sadly lost his seat along with many others in Gravesham, is that they are slam dunk reform at the moment, like right. hardcore reform, as is many parts of Medway.
Yeah. So in that sense, I mean, do you think that the Tory brand is kind of spent? Is there a way back that they can regain that sort of trust?
Oh, there's a way back. But it's just whether or not you can find the right leader to actually do it.
Right. Is Kemi Badenoch the right leader?
Well, I'm already on record of being quite critical of Kemi because, you know, I was triggered by the fact that in a local election year, she didn't attend the Kent Party conference.
Right.
Which, you know, not looking at troops in the coalface prior to their slaughter is not good in my book.
Mm.
However, she is trying to change some things centrally, like she's reforming the processes for the selection of party candidates, which I hope is going to be done very, very well. Crucially, and this is the thing that she's doing right now, which could change everything, is she's reviewing the party's policy as it pertains to leaving the European Court of Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
That report is due to come back in time for party conference. And I hope and pray that it concludes and we adopt as our position leaving the European Court of Human Rights for various different reasons.
Such as?
Well, essentially, there is a fundamental problem with the legal system in the UK and asylum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, famously, infamously, since Labour coming, we've had 50,000 illegal migrants cross the English Channel, which is completely and utterly ridiculous. And actually, your listeners should think of it from this way. No invading force that Britain has ever faced, whether it was Napoleon, whether it was Hitler, ever got 50,000 troops over the English Channel. This is completely unprecedented in our history. Leaving the Court of Human Rights will be essential in terms of giving the levers of power back to our sovereign parliament to make the changes necessary. Crucially, it won't change everything in and itself. There is a whole myriad of legal aids that exists, like a legal soup that originated with Blair that has now matured into this sort of big mishmash web of quangos and different outsourced bodies run by judges where they're making decisions that politicians ought to make instead that need to be undone through domestic legislation. But crucially, we can only do that after we've left the international body.
Mm. I mean, some of the language used there in terms of an invading force and this, you do view it in that sense of these people should not be here under any circumstances.
Well, the idea that there is sufficient unrest in a world that 50,000 people need to leave France to come to England is nonsense. It's just factually nonsense.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not like against other cultures. I mean, I'm quarter Dutch.
Right.
Ironically, the only nation since the Vikings to successfully invade part of England was the Dutch, here in Medway.
Mm.
Didn't last very long. They were chucked out straight away. But what else can you classify it as, you know, particularly when these vast majority of these young, fit men, they're either coming for work, in which case they should apply to come legally, and we can assess them whether they could contribute to our economy or not, and whether we want them and have space and capacity for them. But, you know, in terms of numbers, we have a huge population problem at the moment and strain on our resources, our infrastructure, on our social services, educational institutions, by and large caused by overpopulation from migration.
Mm.
I mean, famously, if you look at the current domestic demographic trends, by 2031, our native English population here in Kent is actually due to be lower than it is today. So in the context of all these local plans and devolution argy-bargy that's going on at the moment, it makes you wonder, for who are we actually bricking over our countryside for?
And you think it's not native Brits, as it were?
Not necessarily, no. It's in response to the National Planning Policy Framework, which forces local authorities to plan for and allocate areas for house building according to demand. Demand is based on an equation that consists of native population, demographic demand, as well as migration, so it factors that in, And then it has two multiplier effects. The first bias is towards areas that are already slightly urban. So in a sense, it favours urbanisation rather than getting rid of fresh countryside, which some say is very unfair. And the other multiplier effect is that it places more requirement to build in areas with high house prices, which, you know, is meant to intend to encourage areas where people want to live to build the houses. But you can also argue that actually areas which are showing to be most overheated because of that excessive demand are being forced to get even more overheated. In a sense, the framework works with incremental growth, which we have seen. But unfortunately, the framework is also baking into policy decisions being taken today, decisions based on demand fed from migration numbers, which are historically unprecedented.
Right.
So even if a politician tomorrow was to put up the drawbridge and would have no one coming in or out, you'd still have this requirement based on the national policy framework that looks slightly backwards to build based on this huge demand. And that needs to be addressed.
I mean, I opened this interview by saying, you know, you're at the grassroots, you're a councillor here in Medway, but you've also been at the sort of upper echelons of the Tory party. That gives you sort of a unique perspective on both ends of that spectrum. Do you think that the people at the top of politics understand the local level of local politics?
It really depends. It's like everything in life. There are good and bad people at all levels. I would say there are thirds, right? In my experience, there's one third of people who are obsessed with obtaining power because they want to obtain validation or status. They tend to be the people who become ministers first, but then don't do anything with the power they have and don't want to rock the boat because they want to maintain their position.
Right.
Then I would say there are a third of people who shouldn't even be MPs because they're just completely unqualified. But our system gives everyone equal opportunity on paper, not in practice, to actually become an MP. So there are swings and roundabouts for that. And then there are a third of people who genuinely care and genuinely do the right thing. But the other thing that I've learned over working inside the system for the last 8 years is no amount of checks and balances, no rule book, no code of practice can regulate away the need for an individual's sense of morality. If you don't have a sense of morality and a moral compass, you will corrupt anything in politics. And I think as a society, we've moved away from this need to have a sense of moral judgment. And I think that's a real shame.
I didn't mention it earlier, but in the last election, you did stand for a seat to Parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
You were unsuccessful, unfortunately. But
Worse than that, I got my arse handed to me by Scousers, deservedly so. I've never been hated more in my life. I've travelled all over this country, right? And I generally find I'm welcomed everywhere. But in that context, the Scousers, they handed it to me. Oh, my God. It was visceral abuse.
Oh, good grief.
It was I loved it, though. But this is the thing. The party system meant that I had to stand in a, quote, unwinnable area for us, which that is. You're never going to, you know, because of various different reasons, which are very valid. But then, of course, it means you have people who desperately want to represent the home area of Kent or South Essex, where I also have ties to. They're not allowed to. And you'll go far away. And then you have to put this false front on, which I never did. I was very upfront and honest with people who I was and why I was there. Which some thought were very good, some thought was silly of me to do, but I did it nonetheless. I learned a lot from the experience, but it's not something I want to repeat. I want to represent an area where I have a genuine local connection.
So, following on, is your ambition to enter Parliament eventually, whether that be, you know?
I would love to be an MP, including in the current Parliament. Oh my God, the things I would do and say. It would be very good for the country, I think, and also very personally rewarding for me. You know, having watched people do the job for so long, and then you make all these mental notes like, what's good, what's not good, what to do, what not to do. You know, it's like, oh, I'd love to have a chance and try and make a change. I was successful in changing the law a couple of times in the last Parliament through supporting the work of MPs, but I would love to change the law for the betterment of people's opportunities in my own name. So it's something that I'm definitely going to do at one point.
And would that be as a Conservative MP or has, like some of your fellow colleagues, does reform, you know, call to you at any level?
Well, you know, like initially I thought to myself, well, what's this? I mean, I've known Farage for many years. I actually had like a 2-hour meeting with him back in 2018 when he was in European Parliament as my local European Parliament representative for the South East. Mm-hmm. And he was very gracious with his time. And, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to meet him is because I, you know, at the time the papers writing him off as like a racist. So mm-hmm. I wanted to go there and ask him all these questions and figure him out. And essentially, my assessment of him was some kind of like military history nerd who just wants to have a crack at it, but generally understands people's grievances and mm-hmm. a supremely talented communicator. I'm not decided yet on whether or not the vehicle that is currently being built with reform is the best way to do things. I would still like to think that the Conservative Party is the way. Mm-hmm. And it ties me back to something you said earlier about, is the brand dead? So the current guise of the brand, which essentially is pretend nothing is a problem, blame Labour for everything, don't take any ownership, mm-hmm. don't even tell people what conservatism even means, do nothing.
Yeah.
You know, that is dead and good riddance to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the Conservative brand, you also have these things like Churchill, the greatest Briton who ever lived, who without which we'd all be speaking German and saluting to the Nazi flag.
Yeah.
So there are ways in which you can rekindle the brand and go back to the Conservative and Unionist Party original branding, which Benjamin Disraeli had a hand in designing and something that I'm very passionate about and have this whole grand vision about. But it requires someone very talented to do that and who people can trust. But I think people will always judge people by who they are and place their trust in them where it matters.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Councillor Robbie Lammas.
Thank you very much.
It's been announced by the Home Office that more live facial recognition vans are to be rolled out across 7 police forces in England in a bid to track down suspects of crimes such as sexual offences, violent assaults and murders. The 10 new vans will be equipped with cameras which scan the faces of people as they walk past, then check them against a list of wanted people. The technology is already being used in London, where the government says in the past 12 months 580 arrests have been made, which included 52 registered sex offenders who have breached their conditions. But some campaign groups are worried, and Big Brother Watch is bringing a legal challenge against the Met. So, Dan, what do you think?
Obviously, this kind of technology has existed for a while and is now getting good to the point where it can actually be used by law enforcement. Famously, it's very widely used in China, or particularly in quote-unquote high-security areas of China, like in Xinjiang. And yeah, the criticism of it is that it's a far-reaching and possibly arbitrary expansion of state power and surveillance over people. And I think it's pretty clear that this kind of thing seems to exist in inverse proportion to the police's actual, you know, ability to solve crimes in a more obvious and meaningful way. Yeah, they boast about getting, you know, 500-something arrests in London over the course of the year. There are probably 500 crimes in London over the course of any given week, if that. So I doubt it will make any massive operational benefit to the police in terms of actually catching criminals and solving crimes. And also the reason people are critical of it is the wider the government's capacity for surveillance and that kind of thing, the more likely it is that it will be used to an effect which is, you know, detrimental to people's, you know, civil liberties and basic freedoms which you're entitled. So I think it is a slightly concerning expansion of the power of the state, which probably won't actually help the police that much and is arises in large part out of the police being generally seen as quite ineffectual at solving crimes otherwise.
Some people may disagree with you, but yeah, I mean, Robert, what do you think? Would the money be better spent on more bobbies on the beat?
Personally, I do think that more active police officers patrolling the streets would be a more effective. I know certain people say it's not of great use of resources, but I think there has been a focus in terms of policing, in terms of responding to crime rather than prevention. And I think this technology, it can identify criminals and, you know, obviously we want criminals to be caught, but it can only catch them after they've... It doesn't prevent crimes being committed. It just catches people after the fact. Actual patrolling police officers has that preventative element because they are about... So if, you know, there's that element, if you're a criminal and you think, oh, I'm going to commit a crime in this area, you have to consider the fact that there is a police officer there. I understand why they've done this. It's because recruiting is very difficult because basically police officers are put in quite dangerous situations a lot of the time and they want to be paid to undergo that danger. That's quite expensive, whereas to get this technology, it's a comparatively cheaper
and can be seen to be more effective. But actually, I don't think in terms of the actual prevention of crime, I don't think it is.
I don't know how I feel about this. I think on the face of it, I think it's a good thing. We've got this technology available to us. Why shouldn't we be using it? If people are coming up with this kind of thing, it would be wrong not to. It's fair enough to say, you know, okay, if you've got nothing to fear, if you're walking down the street and your face is being scanned, and let's face it, our faces are being scanned dozens of times a day anyway, through the CCTV that is already on the street. And this is obviously a slightly different, that you're being, you know, lined up against lists that exist. So if you've got nothing to fear, you've got nothing to worry about. But it always comes back to, it's only going to be a good thing if this is going to work how it should do. And we all know from bitter experience, that doesn't happen all the time. Now, I've got nothing to fear. Would I feel the same way if my face has been scanned, I've been accidentally mismatched against somebody who's wanted for a crime, and then I end up in a police cell for several hours while somebody tries to sort out and realise that it's not me after all? Am I going to be a bit fed up about that? Yeah, of course I am. And you could say, okay, well, that's the price we pay for having this technology available and keeping our streets safer. But the fact that it could actually disrupt my life, I don't know, it's a really complicated question, and it's going to come back down to, does it work properly? And we'll see what happens. I mean, it's worth pointing out as well that these seven police forces that it's being rolled out to, one of them isn't Kent, but no doubt it'll be a matter of time before it does actually arrive with us. So we'll see. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Dan and Robert for their contributions, and to special guest Robbie Lammas. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage. You can also sign up to our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.